in the immortal words of Mr. Rogers. Hi, neighbor. Welcome to the first episode of the Positively Power Ranch podcast, where we explore, together, what makes our community work. From the people behind the events we enjoy, to the day-to-day logistics and the neighbors that make up our community. Today, I'm excited to introduce you to our first neighbor on this podcast, Russ Wicks. Russ is a self-taught engineer with a background in motocross. He holds both land and water speed records, has been on the cover of Wired magazine, and built an impressive car from the ground up that he debuted at an auto show in Dubai. He is currently bringing his background in motocross and engineering to bear on exercise science. When you meet him at a community potluck, you should ask him about the cool tech he has cooking in his garage. And now, my friends, my neighbors, Russ Wicks.
I think ultimately when we selected, you know, the Power Ranch community to move to, we were hoping in an ideal world we would have this, and it's amazing. I mean, this morning my wife got up and went for a walk, and you know, she goes down the pass. I mean, Power Ranch has like 26 miles of trails. It's phenomenal, and you know, she bumps into 30 or 40 people she says hi to along the way. I mean, how awesome is that? You know, it's super cool.
We're supposed to start recording this at 8:30. It is now 9:30 because we had to walk from the carriage house to the ranch house. And I think we bumped into probably 40 people between there. And it took almost an hour to get started today.
Exactly.
It is a community.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, we started saying hi to each other and some of the other parents that were bringing their kids to school. And, it was kind of, you know, natural to just, you know, talk a little bit more and, you know, ask about which part of Power Ranch which area you lived in. And because we kind of met at sort of a certain area just right up the street, and then would walk together or pass each other. And so, yeah, it was super cool.
Right on. So you said you were hoping to find this here. What got you to the point where you were hoping for this? Is it like, did you know that you were like looking for a neighborhood like this? Like your background, I feel like I get the vibe that you could live, when a lot of people say they could have lived anywhere in the world, right? But this is like especially true for you. You've been to a lot of places, and yet you're here in Power Ranch. How did you find this place and then build this vision of what you were going to find when you moved here?
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I'll start off with saying that I've been to most of the states, you know, in the U.S., and you know, at least 17 different countries. I've traveled a lot, saw a lot of parts of the world. And growing up, I grew up on the foothills of Mount Rainier, you know, outside of Seattle, Washington, very rural. There was loggers and farmers. And we had 70 plus acres and had horses and cows and a little river, small stream that ran through our property. And, love that. We had neighbors, but they were, you know, further away. But we had one group of neighbors that were like right next to us. It was the Calero family, and they actually had 16 kids from the same mother and father.
That is anxiety inducing.
It was amazing.
That's awesome.
I became you know, great friends with the family, and really got a sense of, you know, community and how important neighbors are. You know, if you ran out of something, you needed to borrow something, or, you know, you would, you know, make extra food or such as my parents had, and, you know, you would share with the neighbors, and especially they needed it with 16 kids.
Literally asking for, hey, do you have a cup of sugar, neighbor? Like, yeah, your old trope.
Yeah. Yeah. And they would share stuff with us.
That's so awesome.
You know, growing up like that was amazing. At some point, probably teenage years, I felt like I wanted to be a city boy. I wanted to get away from that. I wanted to, you know, I wanted to wear a suit and wingtip shoes and, you know, go to, you know, the big cities and have that kind of a Wall Street kind of, you know, Milan kind of, you know, environment. And, I thought that was the thing maybe dreams were made of, because it was different from, you know, from what I had experienced as a kid. And, you know, Hollywood was sort of like, you know, glamorized and these areas. And quite frankly, as much as the Pacific Northwest is amazing and beautiful, the rain is just, you know, it literally does rain there, like, you know, 7 full months out of the year. And it's super depressing.
I lived there for a bit. There's a reason grunge music came from Seattle. There's not a lot of sunlight there.
no question. That's absolutely true. So I wanted to escape from there. And I did. And spent a lot of time as a teenager in Southern California. And really love the beach vibe and the surfers. And, you know, I had a background in motorcycle racing as a kid. And it was super fun and relaxed. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. One of the best places in the world. And, you know, after living in some other places and traveling a lot, my wife, Megan, and I, we ended up living in Southern California, you know, just, you know, in a beach community in Orange County. And it was amazing. But after a while, we felt like it still had a lot of this pretentious kind of Hollywood vibe. And it seemed like, you know, not everyone, because a lot of people are, you know, out and it's sunny and beautiful and not locked in the rain in Seattle, but there, a lot of people have this agenda. And so I kind of, you know, like you're wondering what people's motives are. And not in a bad sort of way, but it just didn't seem as friendly as, you know, the next door neighbors growing up as a child. And, you know, I lived actually at one point, you know, in the top floor of a building in downtown San Francisco. Also lived on the 17th, 18th floor of a skyscraper in Seattle. And so, you know, I experienced that downtown living lifestyle, which was a lot of fun, but it kind of, you know, felt really gross to me after a while. And
why is that?
Yes. I was just so far away from just nature, really. Mm. You know, the plants and trees and animals and people that are just, you know, going about their lives, like, you know, in enjoying the day and you know, not this hustle bustle kind of lifestyle of, you know, trying to, you know, get ahead by, you know, knocking everyone else down. And I you know, certain people in certain business environments. So, you know, being in California, we really liked it for a while. And then at some point, we discovered that we were not liking it as much. And then our kids, you know, were no longer infants and you know, now in grade school. And we said, we need to move somewhere completely different. And, you know, for them and, you know, for a better lifestyle, both educationally and just, you know, socially. And I wanted to experience the things that, you know, specifically I grew up with in that rural community with a neighbor. So long story short, that was part of the reason why we ended up in Arizona and in the Phoenix Valley. And, you know, we did a lot of investigation, and inside the Phoenix Valley, the southeast corner seems to be, you know, very rural, and there's, you know, still lots of farms and trees and so we kind of, you know, really homed in on this area and looked at the schools and the safety aspects and ultimately picked Power Ranch.
So what was it about Power Ranch? You said there's the schools, the safety. There's I guess, what's the confluence of all of that in this neighborhood that really sold it to you? Was there a moment where you knew that it was going to be Power Ranch, or was it something that you slowly discovered through the search? Like, how did you find?
Yeah, I, and my wife would say that I spent a tremendous amount of time doing this whole investigation. I mean, it was like, you know, one of those FBI shows where, you know, you got the map and, you know, the thumbtacks and, you know, strings attached and, you know, so I was overlapping, you know, the crime incidences with, you know, the best schools. And, you know, and our kids were elementary school age. So we wanted to find the best elementary school in the area, a top school, 10. And we also wanted to not move right away. So we wanted to make sure there was a junior high that was like a 10 and a high school that was a 10. And after, you know, doing all this cross-referencing stuff and looking at everything, quite frankly, there was a couple options, but by far, this particular community stood out first and foremost above everything. And that was regarding what was best for our kids, really, in school. Our kids go to public schools now, but my feeling was if the public schools were good here, which they were horrible in California and some other places across the country, if the public schools here were good, if we decided we wanted to do something different, like a charter school or a private school or something else, then we were making an assumption that they'd be even better.
Right.
And what we found is, you know,
the public school is standard setting, right? And
absolutely. Absolutely. So
you have found that.
We absolutely have found it. We're, you know, really happy with the way that our kids are, you know, getting their education. And you know, there was that time in, you know, 2020, 2021, where the schools were shut down in California, and we did some homeschooling, which to me, that memory was, it was pretty much all positive. I mean, it sounds really odd to say that, but it brought us together super, super close as a family, realizing, you know, what we really needed versus what we wanted, you know, and we spent more, you know, close time together and doing activities that, I mean, we were in Orange County. We went out, you know, we did our stuff. It didn't affect most of the stuff we're doing. We rode our bikes to the beach, you know, all the time. And I had my own office. So my kids came into my office and we set up one of my office rooms as a classroom. They had whiteboards and our kids would come in and they'd have their agenda. You know, they'd write down the agenda for the day, right? It was like, you know, Pledge of Allegiance and, you know, roll call. And, you know, then they'd do math and you know, they'd have a break, you know, and then they'd jump in and they'd do some reading, and then they'd have another break and do, you know, maybe a bite to eat, and then they'd have gym class. So fortunately, you know, I've involved in the fitness industry a little bit. So you know, they would do their fitness activities there and work out, and we had this routine, and that was also, I think, one of the things that that worked out really good was it wasn't a huge disruption for them. That, you know, they weren't just out of school at home just doing something really, you know, weird. I mean, yeah, they were in daddy's extra office, but it was the routine of, you know, going through and doing the work and the school work that the, you know, the district provided with you know, the laptops. You know, our kids would, you know, in 30, 45 minutes, they were done for the day. Mm-hmm. It was ridiculous. So, you know, my wife and I have always given our kids extra work to do. Always. Still to this day. I mean, you know, it's like, hey, when you get home, you're going to read for 30 minutes, you know, but sometime between now and bedtime. And, you know, we're a stickler about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's awesome.
And I think that's always, it's always helped them accelerate. But that factor of being able to go through and hang out and spend, you know, more time with your children at that age, and let them know that, hey, you know, we're having fun. You know, there's not that much stuff to be worried about. I mean, I've lived this life of kind of a you know, some daredevil activities and you know, a sports, extreme sports career. And so, you know, I was always someone that had no fear. I mean, my biggest fear was not taking a risk. So, you know, our kids kind of, you know, they saw that and they're like, hey, yeah, you know, we're, you know, the world's going to survive and we're going to be okay and we're going to get through this. And we did. So, but the schools, unfortunately, were a disaster in California.
I feel like you had a 9 or a 10 in dad's office school at home, right? And then the pandemic ended and now you had to go back to the California public schools and they were being compared against this baseline of what you had just structured. Was that a big part of, because I'm noticing the timeline of you becoming our neighbor and the pandemic ending. They line up fairly well.
They do.
So did that lead in? The kids went back to school and
That's an excellent observation. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, in hindsight, absolutely, we realized how, you know, bad the lack of educating to their abilities was taking place. And we're like, you know, what we need to do something different. And, you know, my wife stays busy with her career. She has the flexibility of, you know, working from home, which is great. She loves that. And I do too, for the most part. I mean, I'm very flexible. So, I mean, we were in a situation where we could have homeschooled our kids. We thought about it. But we thought about a lot of other things in California that was taking place. You know, we lived in a nice area. Nice community, beach community, as I mentioned, and you know, there's like armed robberies at the grocery store.
That's scary.
Very scary. It got to the point where, you know, my office was just, you know, a couple blocks from the beach in Newport Beach, and if I was going to come into the front entrance of my door to my office, I would have to sometimes step over homeless people because they were like camped out in front of the office. And so I would park in the back and come in the back warehouse entrance. And then, you know, you're worried. You leave at night. You don't know if, you know, someone's, you know, I worked late a lot of times, if someone's, you know, going to jump you or do something crazy. So there was a lot of factors where we're just like, we just got to get out of California. Yeah. I mean, in general, you know, Arizona is a very, I'd call it a very free state. And, mm-hmm. and, there's, you know, there's a lot of, you know, reasons related to, you know, government and taxes and so on, why, you know, so many people are escaping California and moving to places like Arizona. So, but first and foremost, it was all about our children. Their environment, the social aspects, and the schooling and education, and everything else was just like an amazing huge bonus. Like, could Power Ranch be like the ultimate, you know, blend of everything, having that rural environment, but also this kind of urban, you know, atmosphere. If we want to go to shopping mall, it's, you know, it's right up the street. Mm-hmm. We have, it's like everything, you know, there's a Home Depot just on the other side of one side of Power Ranch. On the other side, there's like a Lowe's. And then there's another, like, you know, Shopper Supply, you know, sporting goods store that's massive, mm-hmm. you know, on the other side of it. We have a world-class, like, climbing gym, you know, on the north side of Power Ranch. And you know, on the other side of Power Ranch over by the Home Depot, national caliber ninja training facility. You know, it's just, like, everything's here. It's amazing.
Almost in walking distance.
if you want to walk, which we love to walk and mm-hmm. ride our bikes, I mean, you could go to all of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, that close. That's absolutely awesome. Yes.
So I guess you've hinted at it a few times. You said you did extreme sports. What kind of extreme sports did you do?
So my I was aware of my father doing some auto racing mm-hmm. when he was, you know, much younger, and
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. And so as a young kid, there were some trophies that he had. And I remember, you know, the first time I saw auto racing on TV, I was just like fascinated. I watched the whole thing and I'm like color crayon, the, you know, the cars. And I'm like, I want to do that. That's what I want to do.
This is what you want to be when you grow up.
That's what I wanted to be. And we had horses instead of, you know, motorcycles or go-karts, but that's soon changed. And it was funny, actually, that I remember the first time my dad said, "Hey, yeah, we're going to get rid of your little pony and we're going to get a motorcycle." And I probably, you know, cried for a week straight. But, you know, it turned out to be a blessing for me. So, I grew up with, you know, small go-karts and then motorcycles and started racing at age 10. And very seriously, I mean, I was one of those kids at age 10 that felt like, you know, I want to be a racer. I can't race cars yet because I'm not old enough to drive. But I'm going to be the best motorcycle racer I can be. And to the point where, you know, probably very early teen years, I was out training and, you know, I'd go run 5 miles a day for my fitness to be better, to be a better motorcycle racer, motocross racer. And I was super dedicated. I think, so I did 5 years like as an amateur and then 5 years professional. You know, did pretty well. You know, raced in some, you know, big races, a couple Supercross and some national championship races. And, you know, ultimately, really, you know, never won any big, huge events or championships. You know, I was kind of a mid-packer guy, but, you know, back then, mid-packer was, you know, a big deal. And, you know, I was probably one of the top 100 motocross racers, you know, in the United States at the time. So it was a great experience. And I think I'd competed in over, you know, 700, you know, motocross or go-kart races. So that was a lot of racing. I mean, we would race Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, almost year-round, even when it was raining, downpouring crazy in the Pacific Northwest. But as a kid, you know, we'd go to Oregon, you know, many weekends or California even. So
I feel like your personality is like really relaxed, but in terms of like, your energy, when you bring it to bear on something you want to do, you have a very intense energy.
Yeah, I think most people think I'm pretty mellow. Mm-hmm. And most of the time I'm very mellow, but I'm also very intense. I mean, I'm, you know, I have a lot of energy, you know, that leg bouncing, you know, just wanting to go, you know, can't stand still, tackle the next thing. So, you know, I grew up with that. And I think, you know, that also, you know, went along with, you know, having a lot of persistence and tenacity and that kind of, you know, never quit, you know, never give in attitude. And moving forward, I started auto racing. First race car I drove was in France, which was amazing.
That's wild. That's a wild place to first get into a how did that happen in France and not the United States or like Washington?
Yeah, it was a really unique situation where, and I was 19 at the time. There was a racing school in France, and the French government at the time, they own a lot of companies, right?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So the French government, you know, basically owns like Renault cars and Michelin tires and like Elf Petroleum.
Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Owned, controlled, you know, it's not like private enterprise here.
Interesting.
So Renault cars, you know, at the time, they were starting to sell them in the United States. And I'll back up. Because the French government wanted Formula One drivers and Formula One winners and champions to be French because of the national pride.
Mm-hmm.
And they had developed this program, a racing school exclusively for French drivers that went from, you know, go-karts to like Formula Renault, Formula 3, Formula 2, and up to Formula 1. And they had this kind of a scholarship program. So at the time, Renault was selling some cars than the United States. And somewhere along the line, they decided that it would be a good idea maybe to have some American kids come over and come into this program because it would cross over eventually to
selling more Renault cars to Americans. It was a long-term program. It was very thought out. And also, they didn't want, same with the French kids, the U.S. kids, they didn't want them to have prior auto racing experience, specifically in road racing.
Because you're showing off the school on top of it, right? You're showing off a whole, the from 0 to 60, literally.
No, that's pun intended. Yes. So that's part of it. And also it was from a standpoint of when you're starting with a clean sheet of paper, it's really nice to go through and you know, develop, you know, what you ultimately want than something that, you know, is a kind of a mess and has some bad habits.
It's so hard to unlearn bad habits. The best time to take golf lessons is when you've never golfed. And
yeah. That's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Pretty much most disciplines are like that. So I had, you know, vast, like I said, 700 races in motocross, of, you know, a vast amount of racing experience. Did a little bit of go-karting stuff, but, you know, never raced a car. So I applied for it and I got, you know, chosen to go to this program. And there was probably 12 of us Americans from across the country. You know, a couple of them had done motorcycle, you know, road racing. There were some, you know, a number of them that had done karting, go-karts, and like maybe dirt car oval racing. So they had some racing experience, but not road racing experience. So they taught us from the, you know, ground up. And so that's, I got, and maybe I got picked and invited because I was one of only 12 people that applied. I don't know.
You'd like to think that's not the case, but.
Yeah, that's true. And I didn't win. They had a competition and a scholarship. Whoever won got to, you know, a fully, you know, funded program to live over in Europe the next year and compete at the next level. And so I didn't win. I did pretty well. But that was, you know, it was a great experience, a good springboard. And, you know, over the next, you know, handful of years or so, I tried to have a full-time racing program in a specific series, but it was really difficult. It's unlike a lot of stick and ball sports or other things where, you know, your natural talent can carry you because, you know, at some point you need like a multi-million dollar sponsorship to even enter the event.
And, that makes sense.
Yeah. So I did a variety of formula car racing across the U.S., a little bit in Canada, kind of sporadic, and did some of the supporting events at the IndyCar races and actually worked up to was entered in the Indy 500 one year and went through the rookie orientation program and, you know, didn't actually compete in the race because we had some sponsorship, you know, lack of sponsorship issues, but had ran speeds of, you know, over, you know, 200 plus miles an hour in an Indy car. So that was a lot of fun and a great experience.
That's a lot of miles per hour.
It is. It is. So that was, you know, part of my career to a certain point. So, and it was got more extreme after that.
Yeah, it got more extreme. This was already intense. But so how did that lead into, so you hold like land and speed records, or no, sorry, not land and speed, land and water speed records. How did this seems like it's setting the stage for you to start pursuing that. Did this lead into that? Were there steps in between?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of the stuff in my life, just that, you know, experience of growing up, going from the, like we mentioned, the rural area to the, you know, downtown, you know, big business stuff and, you know, creating and developing your personality and, you know, coincided with all the racing experiences I did. And I got to the point where, you know, I was struggling to have the funding to be an IndyCar driver. I had teams that said, hey, we'd like for you to drive. We have some sponsorship, but you need to find some more. So I, as I mentioned, grew up in Seattle, Washington. Seattle was the mecca, like IndyCar racing. Indianapolis is sort of the mecca of IndyCar racing. Most of the IndyCar teams are based in Indianapolis.
That makes sense.
Drag racing, years ago, most of the teams were based in Southern California, where drag racing started. Mm-hmm. NASCAR was, you know, sort of Daytona and, you know, some of those other, you know, places in the South. Seattle was the mecca of unlimited hydroplane boat racing. Like the big,
I didn't know that,
Miss Budweiser boat, you know, with the pontoons. And, you know, back in the day, they had the you know, the aircraft engines, the Allisons and the, you know, World War II, you know, engines out of the planes. And then
that's why they strapped them to boats.
They did. People were creative, inventive. I mean, I love that stuff.
That's wild.
And then ultimately, they went to using L7 Lycoming motors out of the Chinook helicopters. And so there's still a prop that spins in the water because, you know, it's just like the blades and the propeller spins, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, when this turbine Lycoming spins up, they developed a specific gearbox. And it went down to a prop shaft and then a prop spinning in the water. So, you know, the unlimited hydroplanes, you know, create this massive rooster tail. And they run on oval track races with buoys out there. And Lake Washington was one of it was the number one biggest attended sporting event of the year. All the people that went to Lake Washington to watch the hydroplane races. It was amazing.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
Yeah. Like Indianapolis for the Indy 500. So I was surrounded by that and aware of that growing up. And I had some friends in that industry because, you know, racers kind of cross over and, you know, people in some other forms of racing. But at some point, someone mentioned to me that there was this, one of the most dangerous speed records in history was this, you know, world water speed record and specifically the propeller driven world water speed record. And world speed records, they require you to go through a measured mile. So you can have a big run up, you go through a timing device, it starts the timer, you go a 1 mile distance, and then the clock shuts off. So it's the average speed over the mile.
I didn't know that. I assumed it was the peak speed, and that it is not.
It's not. It's the average speed over the mile, but it's also the average speed for both directions. So you have a limited amount of time where you need to turn around and come back and do the same thing the opposite direction. In the case of maybe winds blowing one direction helping you, or in water, there could be, you know,
the current,
water current, mm-hmm. and air. So they actually average the speeds over both directions of the measure mile. So I have some friends that have done, you know, the full on top fuel drag boat racing stuff, which is insane. I mean, they've been like 300 miles an hour from like zero to, you know, this very short distance top speed, 0 to 300. It's crazy, insane. But
in water,
it's nuts. But sustaining mm-hmm. a speed, being in on water or land, like NASCAR, you know, they go 200 miles on the track. But sustaining, you know, doing that for a whole mile distance, you know, at a super high rate of speed is a different phenomenon. So, you know, it becomes even more dangerous. You know, stuff spinning the propeller and the, you know, water spinning that fast for that distance. It's not meant to
rapid unplanned disassembly is not fun when you're in the going 200 some miles an
exactly
hour.
Exactly. So someone suggested I do it. I'm, you know, at the time a single guy,
like, this sounds like a great idea,
pretty adventurous. I felt like I had everything to gain by obtaining this world speed record. And I hate to say almost like nothing to lose. I mean, you know, I didn't have a family, I had friends, but I'm like, you know, I'm kind of invincible. I'm, you know, I had no fear mentality. I'm not going to get injured. And long story short, so I actually was successful in breaking this this world water speed record for propeller driven boats over the mile. We did it June 15th of 2000 on Lake Washington, and it was phenomenal.
Which means it's held for 24 years. That's
exactly. And the record was almost, I think, 38 years old before that point.
That's wild.
So, and I still have the record. So basically, I guess the synopsis of my career would be, I'm the only living person to have world speed records on land and water above 200 miles an hour, because I went on to do a, you know, world speed record on land. And also, you know, vast amount of experience in different racing vehicles. I'm sure I've went to more racing schools than anyone else in the entire world. I mean, like a dozen of them. Everyone's like, where did you go to school after, high school? I'm like, I went to the Suzuki School of Motocross, right?
That's naturally.
It starts.
Where did you go?
Yeah, I think I went to three motocross schools as a kid, you know, and then, you know, all sorts of racing, formula car racing schools around the world, and, you know, NASCAR racing schools and drag racing schools and, you know, everything, anything that was available. You know, I did Bob Bondurant Racing School when I was here, you know, in Firebird and Chandler. And then later on, you know, did some little bit of instructing for him, you know, some specific programs. So
that's awesome.
But I've been 200, over 200 miles an hour, you know, in an Indy car, a hydroplane, you know, a NASCAR stock car, a dragster, and almost 200 in a pro stock drag motorcycle, close to it. Didn't quite get there.
That's so wild.
Yeah, a little bit of a daredevil mentality.
I dig that. So how you broke the water speed record for the mile in both directions, and then how long until you decided you're going to do the same thing on land, and how did you end up finding your way to trying to pursue a second record? Did somebody ask you? Did you just decide, hey, I've done this once, why not twice?
What was interesting was, you know, my friends from the IndyCar series, they were now calling me a boat racer.
Oh, and you're like, I started on motorcycles. The boat was just, this is a side quest.
The boat racing guys were calling me an auto racer, and I didn't have an auto racing program, but everyone said, hey, you're a world speed record holder. And I'm like, okay, you know, and that worked out. It was successful, not from just breaking the record, but financially, ESPN did a 30-minute special documenting my water speed record, and we got a lot of publicity. It was awesome. Great for the sponsors.
I was gonna say that probably helped with the sponsorship issue
It did, and so it seemed to me like I need to break another world speed record. So we dove into a couple different things. One was very, very extreme, high level. We were gonna work on building a watercraft from ground up that could go 400 miles an hour on water. 400, that's right. We had a lot of development. Some of the, you know, biggest companies in the United States had their fingers involved in this. Big technical companies and aerospace companies. And we still needed a lot of sponsorship, because this is something to do right. You know, you needed a lot of money. And so 9/11 happened. I literally was signing, in the process of signing a big sponsorship commitment. And 9/11 happened, and the world changed in a huge way, as everyone knows. And, you know, corporate sponsorship was just, you know, pulled from, you know, so many advertisers pulled money from everything, right? And downsized, and especially stuff like racing and motorsports, extreme sports stuff. And especially with the danger aspect of what this was, I mean, it was kind of maybe that, you know, subliminal thing, like, hey, we just had some really dangerous thing happened with airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, you want to do this boat 400 miles an hour with, you know, wings on it and stuff. No, we don't want to touch
that. We want to be associated with safety right now.
That's right.
The opposite. Rapid, unplanned disassembly. Yeah.
But I realized NASCAR was just booming. And I had no experience in, you know, racing NASCAR or anything, but I did the research that there was a NASCAR world speed record, like for stock cars. So in 1971, a racer named Bobby Isaac, he actually won the NASCAR championship in 1971. ironically, racing the number 71 red Dodge Charger. And he went to the Bonneville Salt Flats and did the 1 mile, you know, the measured mile. He established the world speed record. And, you know, went like 216 miles an hour. So I'm like, that's a record that I should break. It's, you know, I think I could do this. Seems pretty easy. You know, technology is better now. And, you know, at that time, that record was, you know, quite a few years. That was 24 years old, you know, when I broke it in 2006. So that worked out. I broke the record in 2006, bumped it up, you know, a little bit. Again, very successful from a sponsorship standpoint. Autodesk, who makes, you know, AutoCAD, mm-hmm. 3D engineering development products. They were our primary sponsor, had a great relationship with them. And ironically, because Bobby Isaac was driving a Dodge Charger and Chrysler had that record for so many years, they came to me after I broke what they called their record and wanted to know if I would be interested in going back, you know, the following year and drive like a red Dodge Charger
that they
would,
cool.
they would fund.
That's very symbolic.
Oh,
I love that.
It's ridiculous. I mean, that doesn't happen to race drivers. I mean, that someone like calls you and wants you to do that, and here's the funding, and it was a substantial situation. I mean, we tested the car, and you know, Chrysler's wind tunnel in Auburn Hills, Michigan, had all sorts of, you know, 3D scans and airflow analysis, computer simulation. You know, a specific engine program that we had, you know, we brought three, you know, extra engines to the Bonneville Salt Flats, and
that's awesome.
And so, I broke that record, my previous record.
You set the record twice.
I did. And, 244 was the average over both directions, but the exit speed, was 249. During one of the runs. So we were like a mile away from the 250 mark. But again, you know, with the NASCARs going about, you know, around 200 max around, you know, Talladega or maybe Daytona, 50 miles an hour is like a massive percentage faster. And to do it, you know, for, you know,
a whole mile in two directions.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, over, you know, well over, you know, 225 to 250. You know, sustain those directions. That's it was really like hanging it out, and took a lot of focus, and it was super intense. And that balance between just, you know, you're on the ragged edge, but you have to be so methodical, and like, you know, there's so much science behind it, and so smooth and so focused. That was it was one of the funnest things I've ever done in my entire life. So that was cool.
I imagine there's a lot of, not just the day of setting the record, but the lead up to it, knowing the team, knowing the engineering behind it, and knowing the vehicle. Like, what does that process look like?
It's enormous. And what's interesting with all three of the speed records that I did, it happened super quick, which is amazing, because, you know, a lot of the stuff you'd sort of like prepare for, you know, maybe several years. And there's a certain time where the body of water, you know, in the morning you want to do it because it's typically calmer in the morning than, you know, more waves in the afternoon, you know, bodies of water like lakes, like mm-hmm. Washington, for example, Bonneville Salt Flats, you know, there's only, you know, a certain period of time when it's not like, you know, a salt lake. It actually dries out and it's like, you know, this desert of salt. So there's a certain time that it's only available to do something like that. So to plan for, you know, that, and the way that, you know, my situation worked with all three records was the sponsorship came together really quick. Like the water speed record was in 2000. It was in the midst of the dot-com boom. I was living in, you know, downtown San Francisco, mm-hmm. and there was lots of sponsorship, and everyone's like, let's spend the money tomorrow. Let's go. People thought it was going away, and it did mm-hmm. later in 2000. Mm-hmm. So
smoke them while you got them.
Yeah. So putting together in all three situations, putting together the team, getting the vehicles ready, everything to down to, you know, the getting, you know, the driver's uniform done with, you know, the sponsors' logos all embroidered, the race, you know, uniforms for the team, again, embroidery, the vehicles painted, the everything. And the vehicles modified and all the, like I said, the engineering simulation testing sort of validation before you go out and test. And you know, really our testing was, okay, we're going to go test and later in the day, we're going to break the record. Mm. It's kind of like that for the most part. Happened super quick, like amazingly, you know, abbreviated time period, like maybe, you know, 40 days. In the case of the water speed record.
40 days from the time that you decided you're going to do this.
Sponsorship's done, world record's broken. And I think probably both the Bonneville records and the stock car were probably, you know, within 60 days. They were super quick. It just happened fast. So it's just
that had
like,
to be a very awesome period of time. I mean, you have very intense energy. I feel like you thrive in... All right, we've decided to do something. Let's go get it done.
Yeah, yeah. No, it. I have that personality, and then as I mentioned, the sort
chill.
Of laid back, mellow. You know, like, you know, I don't get upset of. You know, I'm not a road rage person on the freeway. I'm. You know, my wife would probably say I drive. You know, as conservative and, you know, normal as, you know. Hopefully above normal.
you've been to quite a few schools for driving.
So it was super fun, and a lot of, although, you know, it came down to me putting the foot down, the pedal to the metal, but the massive team effort, you know across the board with everyone that prepared the course at the Salt Flats, and you know, the safety personnel and rescue boats on the water, and, you know, to the actual, you know, engineering team and mechanics that were turning wrenches. So it's fun. It was a blast.
I was doing like background research to get ready for this conversation, and I found a article referencing you, and I was looking at the cover of the article. It was in Wired. It was like Need for Speed, something like that was the title. And I was looking at the cover, and like, yeah, there's the guy with this mask on, but the eyes looked really familiar. You're on the cover of Wired magazine. At what point did they approach you? How did that happen? How did you end up on the cover of Wired?
Well, it's amazing. I mean, you know, a lot of people joke about that. I forget which movie it was that one of the characters was like, I was on the cover of Wired magazine or something. It's a famous movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but yeah, I mean, that happened. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Mm-hmm.
So in 2000, when I was in the Bay Area, I was really connected to like the back end of search engine. I mean, I was a very early adopter. I think CompuServe, which most people never even heard of, was one of the first ways of sending email, you know, over the internet. So, you know, mid to late 80s, you know, I was sending emails to my friends at Microsoft and, you know, other people that were at that level of early adoption technology, internet-wise. And so, you know, fast forward to 2000, one of my friends had started this, it was the Society for Internet Advancement. And it was basically looking forward from, you know, this point. He started in 99, 2000. I was actually an advisory board member. And I didn't know a lot about the internet at the time because, I mean, a lot of people didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But we were looking towards the future and realizing that, you know, this thing could be like the most amazing thing ever. And so many cool things could, you know, happen because of this, but also it could be very chaotic and a lot of really bad things could happen too, you know. And I think we see that today where, you know, the internet, you know, it's a love-hate thing. But at the time, I had russwicks.com. That was my website in 2000. And if, you know, if you search race cars or, you know, speedboats or russwicks.com would come up like number one on the search engines. It was like,
well, you knew the people building the search engine.
I knew the people building it. They did all the tricks back then. And so I was getting a lot of publicity. So, you know, there was a world-renowned journalist that did some stories for, I think Popular Science and, you know, National Geographic and for Wired Magazine. He was wanting to do a story on world speed records. And, you know, he does a search. Okay, you know, speed records. And Russ Wicks comes to the top. So it's like, I gotta talk to this guy. And I was living in Bellevue, Washington at the time, you know, right outside Microsoft's headquarters, of course. And we came and visited me, actually stayed, you know, at our place, hung out. We became buddies and over, you know, just a few days. And he did, you know, extensive amount of interviews with myself and some of my, you know, racing team associates, and wrote an amazing story about the history of speed records, the danger and projects that were moving forward. And so this was, you know, right before 9/11 happened. And you know, Wired, the editors thought, hey, this is cool, and this is a great graphic with a, you know, it's like my helmet, you know, has this sort of specific Russ Wicks pattern with the stars, and you know, you wear the hydroplanes, the boat records, you wear like an air mask, like, you know, Maverick would in Top Gun. So
I got very Top Gun vibes from the cover.
Very, kind of, yeah.
It's funny you said that, because I thought Top Gun when I saw the cover.
Exactly. So yeah, it was on the cover. And it was funny because I had, you know, some buddies in the IndyCar world, and, you know, they were, you know, traveling from some IndyCar race to another, and they'd be in the airport and they'd see this, you know, Wired magazine on the newsstand, and they're like, what? That can't be Russ Wicks. Like, immediately they'd like, it's him.
That's how you're getting phone calls. You're probably getting emails and CompuServe from people you hadn't heard of in a while.
Yeah. CompuServe was gone by then, but but yeah, definitely, yeah, a lot of emails, tons of phone calls, and but that was fun. It was cool, and you know, ultimately, I ended up, you know, I have two Guinness Book of World Record certificates. Guinness Book of Records, they brought someone, you know, the head person that looks after the speed records and signs off the official stuff. He came to the Bonneville Salt Flats when I did the last record in 2007, and so that was, yeah, it was a lot of fun. And now I've kind of, you know, not only downshifted from being the extreme sports, you know, hanging out daredevil, because, you know, I have a family, mm-hmm. and a wife and kids. I've downshifted also the whole like online premise from, you know, being someone that wanted all this publicity, not necessarily for me, but for my sponsors, to never having a social media account to this day. I mean, I just haven't. I text and I email. I don't even text a lot. I mean, just a few people, some friends, but you know, some emails and stuff. And, you know, I'm old fashioned. I'd rather call someone and have a, you know, conversation over the phone, or, you know, meet a cool neighbor and sit, you know, face to face and hang out and, you know, look and look at people's expressions and have this amazing, you know, in-person conversation. And, you know, that's one of the, like I said, one of those downsides of this whole internet advancement thing that's taken place, you know, in the last, you know, several decades. You know, it went from, you know, this, you know, very personal conversations and, you know, over the phone to almost, you know, this isolated stuff. And it's strange to me.
Yeah. I feel like you've got a gift for talking to people. And you've got a gift for community building in a way where, like, I feel like you're more of the Rolodex person than the social media feed person. you know a lot of people, you know where you met them, they remember you. That's a gift. It's awesome.
Yeah, thank you. And I would say that's a good observation. I mean, I think that, you know, that's one thing over the years that I definitely, you know, developed was this, and part of it was a sort of a blend of when I was spending time traveling through Europe, I was treated very well. You know, it, most countries, you know, they just, you know, they love Americans and you know, they want to be hosts and you know, show you around and you know, they're very accommodating. So that blend of, you know, getting the traditional family, you know, let's be a host and let's share and give and, you know, treat everyone nice that I experience, you know, in Europe. Mm-hmm. I also experienced that Midwest, you know, vibe the same way, you know, being in Indianapolis, hanging out, you know, in a month for, you know, when the Indy 500s were taking place, you'd go and there'd be qualifying weekends. And, you know, I've spent several, almost entire months of May in Indiana. And it's that, you know, and other places, you know, Midwest and, you know, around the country. So yeah, being outgoing and, I love to say hi to people. I love to learn to get to know people and, you know, build their trust and, you know, have these kind of fun mutual things in common that you can expand on. It's one of the most rewarding things in life that someone can have. And that kind of loops all the way back to, you know, why we're talking here. We met passing, you know, each other, saying hi to each other, walking our kids to school, and ultimately why, you know, we moved here to Power Ranch and to have that community. And it seems like there's a lot of other, you know, similar people that are very outgoing and friendly here and, you know, are still like neighborly. Like, you know, we only moved here 2 years ago. When we moved here, it was like, you know, Penske, I drove the Penske trucks from California here, loaded up. And, you know, the first one, we kind of hired someone to help us, you know, unload the truck and bring the stuff inside. The second one, you know, we're thinking we can do it ourselves, you know, my wife and with the kids' help. And the neighbors were like on our street are like, oh, you need help, right? We had two sets of neighbors come over, introduce themselves, and like, no, we insist we're helping you unload this truck until every piece of big furniture, every box is out of here. We're going to help. And we're like, No, we got it. They're like, no, we're not leaving. We're just that way. and we've experienced that mentality, you know, over and over, you know, in our neighborhood. We become really close friends with, you know, some of our next door neighbors and you know, and our kids have relationships, like some of the most relationships with, you know, the kids right up the street. And, you know, they go to school together, they hang out, their kids come to our house, you know. I mean, that's another great thing about living here, the weather. I happen to like the heat, but, you know, I mean, we literally spend most days, not all day long, but, you know, when we get the work done and stuff, most days in the swimming pool, like 5 months out of the year. So, you know, it's fun that, you know, our kids can bring their friends over and our kids can go over to their, you know, place. And, you know, it's just, it's right around the, you know, a couple streets over and right down the street. I mean, where else do you have something like that these days? I mean, I'm sure it exists other places. But,
it's rare.
It is rare. I mean, you know, like I said, we were looking for, you know, the perfect ideal environment. And, you know, some benefits we had in California with the weather. So many people, we probably stayed longer than we, you know, probably should have or, you know, really wanted to, only because of the weather, which is so amazing, you know, consistent and a little cooler year round. But it was lacking so much of the other stuff, you know, the stuff that's really, really important, you know, that, you know, being closer to sense of community and
Yeah.
The neighbors. Yep, exactly.
I love that. I think I've observed this from I didn't necessarily grow up, have a full free range childhood, but I was outside a lot, and I would ride my bike to school, which is something I think a lot of people can't fathom today, especially my school wasn't close. My school was, I would ride my bike 4 or 5 miles.
Exactly. I did as well at times. Same thing. Like a 5 mile, you know, little jaunt on your bicycle.
These are experiences that nowadays the schools are ripping the bike racks out across the country. And it's not because of some grand plan to not walk. It's because everybody's independently choosing to not go to walk to school, not walk their kids to school. But it's super common here in Power Ranch.
Right.
That was the deciding factor for us purchasing. We saw kids meet at the corner and hop onto the trail system. You said there were 26 miles of trails. Yep. They hopped onto that trail system. It connects to two schools and they walked to school in the morning. And I was like, I want that for my kids.
Yes. I remember one of the first times you and I, started talking a little bit more than just, saying hello, good morning. We talked about, kind of ultimately where we came from and we moved here, both, not that long ago. And I remember you saying specifically, about the being able to, ride your bike or walk to school and stuff and how important that was. And, exactly the same thing for us. I mean, it's truly sad that, like you said, bike racks, leaving and, a lot of things have changed over time. But, to get back to this, it's like, it's an amazing place, and, I mentioned all the, many, many miles of, the walking trails, bike paths, where we live, And I think most of Power Ranch has this. It's 200 acres, if I'm not mistaken. It's 13 parks inside Power Ranch. It's mm-hmm. phenomenal. I think 26 miles of trails. It's very, very green. 14,000 trees. And what
I didn't know we had that many trees.
Yeah.
That explains. Yeah, that explains the size of the. I was looking at the landscape numbers, and I was like, "This is a huge operation," and that makes sense.
It does. No, it's massive, and what's super interesting is that, and again, this is something that I feel like we really truly have here in this southeast, Phoenix Valley area, and very specific to Power Ranch. With the trees, I mean, we have palm trees, we have pine trees. I mean, it's like, sometimes we walk outside our house when we're walking our kids to school, it's like, I feel like I'm in the high Sierras. I mean, you would have no idea certain days that you're in the desert. It's phenomenal. It's like, it's amazing. So, that's one of the things we truly love also. With the environment, the greenness, the nature side of it, the birds every morning, you hear, different birds chirping and the doves and pigeons.
We're on a lot of migration paths. So you see some pretty cool, for bird watching.
Absolutely.
I'm officially old. I'm watching birds.
You are. Well, I might, but I don't talk about it.
Yes. But we'll walk through, we'll wake up in the morning having our coffee and we're like, I haven't seen that bird in a while. And then you'll look up what that bird is. And it's like, oh, that's from the jungles in South America. And we're on the migration path. And that's pretty cool. But yeah,
exactly.
This is a cool, we have a little oasis in the desert. It's an oasis worth living in. And for the birds, it's worth stopping in.
Yeah. Well, well stated. I like mm-hmm. that terminology is perfect. And then, Power Ranch has done, since we've been here 2 years, they've done a phenomenal amount of awesome events. We try unless we have a conflict with, a kid's activity or, we're out of town, which is rare, we go to, all the Power Ranch community events and some of the most amazing stuff that, we've ever experienced. I mean, you can spend money and go to, Disneyland or Legoland and, spend a day and have fun. It's a blast. Mm-hmm. We've done it numerous times, but But you know, you wait in the line and, you know, it's crowded and there's no escaping. You're there, you're all day long. It's, you know, bumping into people and stuff. Or you could go to like Power Ranch, you know, they did the Winterfest. Okay.
With
the zip line. Yeah. There was a zip line right here in the soccer fields. What place like has a zip line Winterfest for the community? It's free, you know, all sorts of stuff for kids, you know, mm-hmm. you know, from the face painting to, you know, the, you know, pet the animals to, you know, other stuff.
We have the Polar Express train and it does a lap around the, and the kids ride on it. And it makes some childhoods. You wake up, you watch the Polar Express, and then your three-year-old's like, whoa, I love trains. And then you go, and then they get into the Polar Express, and then they ride around, and then you go home and you watch Polar Express again.
Exactly. it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. The Easter extravaganza, we missed this last one, but the year before, there was, I remember, again, all sorts of activities. They had a mechanical bull, you know, again, took place the same place outside the ranch house here, you know, the soccer fields. I mean, mechanical bull riding out, you know, I mean, it was like cool stuff.
Yeah.
And I've been to a few haunted houses, you know, for Halloween activity, you know, over the years,
mm-hmm.
not as many as probably a lot of people go to. Because, you know, it seems like I'm doing other stuff. But now with kids, you kind of, you know, you do that stuff more. But I swear the best haunted house I have ever went to the last 2 years was right here in Power Ranch at the ranch house. I mean, just phenomenal. I mean, the way that you would never believe that going through that was the same, you know, places.
We're literally recording the podcast.
Where we're hanging out right now.
They turned it into a haunted house.
No, it's phenomenal. They do such a good job. And you know, I've attended a few events here. Coffee with a Cop, which there's another one in July taking place. I believe it's here at the ranch house as well.
I feel like most people don't know about this. And it's incredible, like knowing the folks who are in our community. When something happens, you want to know the name of the person who's going to show up to help. That changes the relationship and it changes the kind of support they receive and the kind of support our neighborhood receives.
Yes. Yeah,
I didn't know this existed. I'm going to the next one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, it's super cool. And when I tell other neighbors about it, they're like, oh, we had no idea, right? So I think that, you know, maybe that's one of our missions is to help, you know, get the word out of, you know, current, you know, events like that are super cool, that everyone would go and, wow, if I knew about that, I would have went, or I'm going to that now that you've shared that with me. But also, you know, for us to, you know, throw some stuff up on the wall and see what sticks, like what other kind of cool neighborhood community events could we do that maybe, you know, certain interest groups kind of get together and, you know, kind of hang out and you know, get to know the neighbors better, that sense of, you know, community and you know.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things you said that's interesting is contrasting it with Legoland and Disney World and Disneyland, right? You go to those places and everybody's a stranger and you go there and then you go home and that's pretty much it, right? But here, like I'm noticing my daughter will be like, hey, the kids were talking about Thursday to celebrate out of school. We're all going to the pool to like have a pizza party. Can we go? And it's like, yes, we can. And when you go there, it's your neighbors, and it's easy to do events like this where if you wanted, like when growing up, my school was pretty far away, and it was a commuter school. So if I wanted to hang out with my friends, that was an event, and that was a logistical nightmare for my parents to figure out how to coordinate that with three kids and all the places they wanted to be, because you'd have to go out into the city to meet each other, and it was a thing to do. Where here, it's like, well, let's walk down the trail and go sit at the pool. I'll bring a pitcher of margarita, like Margs. I don't know if we're supposed to bring Margs to the pool or not.
We won't tell anyone.
Right.
Hey, but, just edit that piece out.
We're gonna edit that out. But yeah, you walk down the park or walk down to the pool and then you just sit and you hang out with your neighbors and it's easy. You don't have to put any thought or planning into it. And then the kids get to hang out and they're hanging out with their friends. Mm-hmm. And then occasionally we do something bigger, like the Halloween thing or the Christmas thing, but it's still easy. It's not a logistical nightmare. We wake up, we walk down the trail with the kiddos, and the kids have an awesome experience. And like you said, it's up there at the same level as if you spent thousands of dollars and went across the country to one of these big amusement parks. They get the same level of fulfillment out of that. I love that lens, man.
Yeah.
I hadn't considered it through that before now.
Yeah. Good, good. Mm-hmm. No, it's phenomenal. I mean, when we think about it, my wife and I, we're just like, we're blown away at like how amazing it is. So, super, super cool. We're stoked being here.
If there was something you could, like, a magic wand's a corny trope, but if there was something like, we don't need a magic wand, if we could just show up and make something happen in this community for you that's not happening right now, what do you feel like we need more of or need to add?
So much of the stuff that attracted us here, like that we talked about, the neighborhood, the people that live here, the community, which is amazing. I would love to see even more of that. I mean, you know, I see pictures of like from the 50s and the 60s, like these, you know, black and white pictures sometimes of like, you know, it might be like Newport Beach and, you know, the activities that used to, you know, take place. And some of it's strange, like, you know, people are wearing, you know, like suits and stuff, but like, you know, back then people dressed different. And I'm like, man, it was hot. I mean, they always wore suits. I mean,
why are you wearing that?
I mean, you know, you every time, I don't think I've ever seen you in like long pants, and probably I don't think you've seen me. And we're always wearing shorts and our shirts, right? We're just hanging out.
We live on vacation. This is always in a Hawaiian shirt.
So it's not about the dress, but I always thought, you know, I see these pictures, you know, from, you know, years ago, like, wow, that must have been really cool back then. There were these events and community stuff, and you know, everyone used to come out and do that stuff. And it's not about the size of the event, but it's something about those pictures. There's something
bringing it together.
Something about that's magical. So if there's something, you know, that I would like to see more of, it would be not, you know, massive events like that, but more of just an expansion of the cool stuff we like, more ways for, you know, me to get to know other cool neighbors. And again, the best way for us to share, you know, what's going on and you know, meet other people, you know, whatever that is. I don't know the exact mechanism. Hopefully this podcast can be, you know, shared and some people go, wow, that's kind of cool. You know,
we want that too. Let's make that happen.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Actually, that's all that really needs to happen to deliver on that. We don't need budget, or we don't need it, like literally bring back potlucks, and like all it takes is everybody to wake up on the same day and be like, "Hey, we're all going to hang out today," and that becomes that kind of event.
Exactly.
We should do more of that. Yeah. I agree, man.
We have a mission.
Let's go bring back potlucks.
Perfect.